Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Canis Albinus,
Makalua,
the main team, Mega Bears fan.
Welcome, Internet, to 2021 and the first episode of Polycast in 2021. This is episode 376. And I am one of your regular co-hosts, Mega Bears fan, joined as always by Canis Albinus.
Season 15, woo!
The Me and Team.
Civilization Crawl Stone Soup? Question mark?
And Makalua should be here momentarily.
Hopefully. So how is everyone's New Year?
So far, so good. There's a crawl tournament going on, which is why I said that. Working on that a bit.
Dungeon Crawl Stone Soup, for those who don't know.
Yeah. Fantastic roguelike.
In today's news segment, we learned from the Firaxis website and possibly VentureBeat.com. It's not exactly clear, but Civilization franchise has moved 51 million units over its 25, 26-year history, which is a pretty significant number. According to a certain, VentureBeat says that there were 33 million sold when Civ 6 came out. So Civ 6 has sold 18 million copies.
That Epic exclusive has done them a lot of favors.
Uh-huh. They weren't exclusive to Epic.
Fortunately. That would be quite sad.
Well, that's what happens when you start putting your game on every platform conceivable. You sell a lot more units.
Yeah.
Yep.
That does seem to be the approach that works these days. If you're going to make a game, you want to sell it more.
Put it as many places as you can. Don't make it exclusive to anything or anyone.
Well, and it certainly helps that, like, all the platforms nowadays are just, you know, PCs in a pre-built box. So there's not a whole lot of console-specific optimization the way there was, you know, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah, but to be fair, it's been like that a while. Like, I would say by Xbox 360 days, you're already getting into the point where it's close enough to that.
Yeah.
But there are challenges. Like, you making a game for a controller versus not a controller is pretty significantly different, and that's always been a sticking point for strategy games historically.
Yeah, I was
welcome to Mackie.
She's on mute. There we go.
Hi.
Hello, Mackie. You might need to try to up your volume if you can. I just had a friend telling me last night that one of the big innovations with this new generation of consoles, the PS5 and the Xbox, what are they calling it now? Series S, Series X, both of those, one of those, I keep forgetting.
Xbox One X, Series X, X1.
Yeah, something like that. That one of the big technical innovations... that's making, you know, for example, a game like Cyberpunk play on those consoles, but not the older PS4 and Xbox One, is that the graphics chip is now able to pull assets directly from the hard drive instead of the assets having to go through memory, through the CPU, and then serve to the graphics card, which is a pretty neat technical innovation.
Only works on solid-state stuff.
Yeah.
Which is probably why they haven't been able to do it until recently.
So if you picked up Cyberpunk for one of the last-gen consoles over the winter holiday and are wondering why the heck it doesn't work, that's a big part of the reason why.
Solid State's really come a long way in the last 10 years, now that you mention it. Like, how available flash, how costly it is a lot more favorable these days than 10 years ago.
Yeah, I don't have a PS5 yet, but I've been reading that, like, and hearing online that the Demon's Souls remake has virtually no loading screens at all, whereas, you know, these FromSoft games typically have been, like, 30 seconds to a whole minute for their loading screens on the previous consoles.
It looks and is animated so good, but they didn't update how it plays. It's so archaic in that regard, which is really unfortunate. It's a lot of CDM crap. Oh, well.
Well, I guess it's a damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of thing, because you change it too much, and then the fans of the old game would complain, and I'm a big fan of the old game, so I would probably be one of those complaining.
They changed virtually nothing. Like, the item drop farming, all that stuff. There's almost nothing that's changed from the original. They could have made some basic things to make it more convenient. To be fair, they did, like, a couple things. Like, you can send stuff to the stockpile more conveniently than the original. But there's very little. And there could have been a lot more things like that that were not done. Without, like, changing how the monsters move or whatever. Yeah. Yeah,
I still don't understand the concept of console exclusives.
I think that's something organized by the consoles, right? Where
the consoles, I know they pay games to be only on their platform to get more people to buy their platform, but all it does is make people not play certain games. So I don't know why the gaming companies do it.
Well, yeah, for the consoles, it's like a loss leader sort of thing. They take a loss in order to try to get more people to buy the console, and, you know, that then in turn sells more games on that console, which I think the console manufacturers maybe get some. Do they get a cut of game sales? Third-party game sales? I don't know. Maybe
they get the same. They get the same cut that Steam gets on games sold on Steam.
Yeah, for
which
some
why Steam, which is why Steam's thing is what it is. It's because it's identical to the console cut.
It's not necessarily the development companies that like it as much as their publishers like it, because it means they don't have to spend as much to make the game.
Yeah, well, and I'm sure that, you know, there, even though we were just talking about how there's a lot less console-specific optimization, there still is some. So it is still easier to develop a game for one platform than it is to develop it for, you know, three different platforms concurrently. And particularly when it comes to, like, you know, QA and testing and stuff like that, you just got to do so much more of it.
And that was way more true back in the day. Like, it was like the Square Soft. And then the Square Enix stuff. Like, if you go back far enough, then there were pretty significant technical challenges between consoles and PC, or even just between two consoles, such that the developers being bribed to make an exclusive for one system made sense to the developers as well, because they didn't have to do a ton of work to put the game on multiple platforms. And I'm not sure that that's true to the same extent today. I mean, it's not, you can't just, like, copy-paste it. But compared to what it used to be, where you're, like, putting things on a cartridge versus whatever, probably less true now.
I do know that the Xbox One and the PS4 used the same graphics chip. They were identical, so
yeah.
That's one thing they didn't have to worry about so much.
Good luck with that back in the day. So, yeah, I think this is, like, an archaic thing that at one point made sense, but really doesn't now.
Well, it's not
especially with the PC.
It's not super archaic, because I'm pretty sure that even, like, as recently as the PlayStation 3, it was a nightmare for developers to develop specifically for that, which is one of the reasons that a lot of multi-platform releases during that era, the PS3 port was always the worst and the buggiest. You know, like, you play your Skyrims and your Fallout New Vegas and stuff like that. You know, you go to their wiki pages with the bug lists, and it's like, oh, look, there's only 20 bugs on the Xbox, but there's 50 on the PS3.
The PS3, we kind of push into a corner and pretend it doesn't exist, because it had a really weird memory setup.
Yeah.
Wasn't the PS3 released quite some time ago, too? Like, I think it's fair to call that archaic.
It was like 2005-ish, I want to say. Maybe 2006?
Looks like it was okay.
8 years, that's archaic.
It was the same. It was the same generation as the Xbox 360.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't remember which one came out first, but they were, like, probably within 6 months apart.
The PS3 was kind of a doomed enterprise from the start, because it was way more expensive and, you know, just kind of a mess all the way through. And then the PS4 was better than the Xbox One. So, But we've drifted away from the Civ topic.
A little bit. Just a smidge.
Speaking of clicking into the right window, what's the name of this guy? Wine Guy or Wine Gov? I think it's
like Wine Guy.
Wine
Guy.
Based on
the image, that would make most sense.
Yeah, that is a Y at the end there.
It is a hand holding a clutch of grapes, so I will assume it's a Wine Guy.
Yeah.
He says, throughout history, the armies have pillaged the countryside often and lost the support of the locals when they were pillaging, often to the point where they had to withdraw and change their strategy because of the incurring too much local backlash. In Civilization, this doesn't really happen. It's not even, there's no real impact of the land on Civ units specifically, unless you're talking about not being able to heal at double speed like you can in regular, your own land. So the poster is asking, should there be a change to the game rules such that pillaging has a penalty rather than not pillaging?
Man,
because right now it's just a straight bonus.
It's tough in the context of Civ turns. I mean, which period warfare are we discussing when we're talking about local pushback of any meaningful degree, or even to the extent that armies pillaged? Like, it's just nonsensical to compare World War II times to, like, Renaissance times, to Roman times. Those are all pretty differently executed wars in general.
Well, one thing,
so
with that
I don't
regard,
know that this would make a lot of sense.
Yeah, well, to that point, one of the big things that changed with modern wars as compared to, you know, older wars in, like, the medieval era and earlier is the concept of war crimes. You know, which you don't really have until, like, what, probably World War One, I think, maybe. Maybe the Napoleonic Wars had a concept of war crimes. So you didn't attack civilian populations in, you know, modern warfare because it is, you know, considered a war crime and looked down upon by the global community. But that's also something that's not really implemented in Civ at all either. You can pillage someone back into the Stone Age, you know, from the information era, and the rest of the world doesn't bat an eye. And as long as you don't capture cities, you don't even get grievances, I don't think.
You get grievances for declaring war on somebody, but...
Right, but if they declare war on... Yeah, if they declare war on you, and then you walk in and just pillage every one of their improvements and districts and don't capture a city, like, you know, there's no diplomatic repercussion for you at all.
You know, if somebody was trying to invade New York and they pillaged everything in the tri-state area, there would be people rioting and worldwide would be going, what the hell are you doing? I mean, even though the war itself would be odd, but...
Yeah, these days. But keep in mind that for a substantial chunk of the history, much more so than our current state, living off opposing land was pretty normal.
Right.
And, I mean, the locals weren't exactly excited about it, to put it mildly. But very seldom did they have the means or even the organization to resist it meaningfully. So I'm not sure I'm a fan of cities becoming stronger in a scenario where historically they actually would become weaker because they just had less stuff available to them after all the pillaging.
Yeah, and I responded to this thread as well last night, and my knee-jerk reaction is cities are already easy enough to defend. You know, we don't need cities getting stronger because you pillage tiles. Now, I could be in favor of, as I said before, like diplomatic repercussions. I also suggested the idea that, and other posters did as well, of there being a loyalty penalty after you capture the city.
Mm-hmm.
So if you do pillage all of their land, they're not going to be particularly happy with you, so it would then be harder to hold the city after you capture it, and that would be a trade-off that you would have to think about when you're, you know, sieging the city. Is it worth it to pillage this tile to, you know, heal my unit, or is that going to make it impossible for me to hold the city? I mean, if you're going to raise the city anyway, it doesn't really matter. But I think that would be a better idea than some of the other suggestions of giving the city combat buffs, because as we've said many, many times on this show in the past, defending cities in Civ 6 is already heavily in the defender's favor. And right
I
now,
think the loyalty penalty is not only fair but intuitive, considering what you're doing.
Right.
So yeah, I could be on board with that for sure, and it makes pillaging a little less obvious to do, even though people also probably still do it a lot, but it at least will be less automatic, which is good.
And a small number.
You can make an opinion penalty for it start happening in the late eras, like just when you get to a certain era, the AI start hating you if you start pillaging.
Yeah, like pile on grievances if you start pillaging willy-nilly.
Right, and that's something that's...
Yeah, it would only be like industrial or post-industrial that you start to see that.
Yeah, I mean, because when you drop a nuke on cities later in the game, it pillages a lot of the tiles around it. So
I don't know if I'd call that pillaging, per se.
Well, yeah, you know.
It does destroy pretty nicely, but...
Yeah. You get a penalty for more for the dropping of the nuke, but it's doing a similar thing, so it would make sense that when you're doing not nuke pillaging, industrial, and later, that people are going to clutch their pearls and go, oh!
Right, and especially even during the later stages of the game that represent more modern time periods, where you do have mass media and stuff like that reporting on, these potential atrocities against civilians going on around the world, then that should definitely get a reaction from the wider global community and maybe even, back home, depending on, maybe your government and, popular support for the war, increasing war weariness or maybe even leading to a drop in loyalty in your own cities because, maybe they're actually becoming sympathetic to the enemy that you're pillaging back into the Stone Age for no good reason. But that might be a little bit out of the scope of Civ, because that's getting a lot more, when you start talking about domestic popular opinion, that's, something that's, makes things a lot more complicated.
No, loyalty is about the closest representation we have to that.
Yeah, that and amenity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably all the more we need.
Man, that's another thing. If it's, say you're under democracy in one of those later ages and you go on a pillaging spree, that could start making your amenities less effective. Because back home they're going, no, this is not how we do things. What are you doing?
I think that can depend on your government, too, to be fair.
Or even policies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
If you've got military state or police state, policy active, your people should either be a lot less informed about the atrocities that you're committing or a lot, or just not care as much, or not able to voice that dissent because then they get the atrocities committed against them.
Too real.
Yes, I'm going, no real world examples, no real world examples.
Yeah, we kind of gloss over the implications of running the military-oriented government, and while I would happily run something like fascism in the game, it's not so good when you really think about the implications of that and living in the world where somebody is doing that, but it's a game after all, so.
Oh, yeah, so when you had an example, they were waiting on their spaceship to reach its destination. They didn't feel like conquering, so they just decided to carpet bomb everything and run into the jet bombers. It's like, yeah, that should give you a ton of grievances.
Oh, my goodness.
I'm bored. I'll call it carpet bomb the planet. What?
Oh, another tangential thing that I had mentioned on this thread was the idea that maybe when you pillage a strategic resource, instead of getting like a gold or science yield or whatever it is now, maybe you should just get a lump sum of that strategic resource. I suggested you pillage an iron mine, maybe instead of getting gold and science, you just get like a stockpile of 10 iron, which you can then use towards training units and maybe even using against that enemy.
I'm not sure which is better there.
Or it could be a combination of the two.
Yeah, I was going to say a combination. Have some gold, have some resource. Because that might be just what you need to upgrade one unit to help you fight them off or something.
Yeah. And it would be an extra incentive, for the defender to protect, those sources so that they are not stolen and then used against them.
Give them that one piece of excess iron necessary to repair their units.
Mm-hmm. So, which styles are held? Because Aunt Sal's started this topic. Posted an image, which is hard for you to see when you're listening to this, but it's like, if you're asking, skinning over the image, can you immediately tell which are heels and which are flat? And there's another picture in there where they were showing what they thought. I get that because I think that's been a a comment about the Civ tile set, or hex set in this case.
I took a quick look at this just a little bit before this topic, and I would have put the green circles almost identically to this poster, except for where the question mark is, I would have also had one. So yeah, there are way fewer hills than apparent based on the image, and that has long been a complaint with Civ 6, yeah.
In fact, yeah, I think we just talked about that in like the last episode before the holiday break when we were talking about how good the art style is, except for the fact that I can't tell which tile is
hills.
Yeah, if you don't have yields on, which is like some of the first things said, and I play with yields on as well, you basically can't.
And it's even worse if it's covered by a forest. Like, I mean, for one thing, it's hard to tell on flatland, but then you got a forest or something covering it up, and it's like, is this tile a hill? I don't know.
Yeah, because you have an area of flatland that's all covered with forest, but there's two hills in the middle, but you don't know that until you move a unit on it and go, oops, I thought I could keep moving.
Yep.
That's in the middle of an invasion. That's not fun.
To me, it seems like that would be an easy thing to fix, but maybe there's some sort of underlying reason why that's not something that can be easily remedied.
Exaggerate the shadowing or something, maybe, in the art?
Well, later in this thread, there was someone who actually took a screenshot of the same set of tiles at different times of day in the game with different lighting conditions to show just how different the tiles look under the different lights. And the ones in like the middle of the afternoon do look substantially different than the ones like later in the evening. Like, it's a lot easier to tell in the evening because the shadows are being cast like towards the camera, so you can actually see the shadows. Whereas earlier in the day, the light is directly overhead or actually, a little bit oriented towards the camera, so the shadows are being cast away from the camera where you really can't see them.
Yeah, like looking at this one, it's like about like 8 or 10 in the morning. It's a bit harder to tell because it's almost got a glare going on.
Yeah, and in this case in particular is all on like snow tiles, and as someone who snowboards, I'm like, oh yeah, that looks like snow blindness. That's what it looks like when you go snowboarding without polarized goggles.
It does. But I don't know why that needs to be in the game per se. And as cool as the shadows of being on different sides as the sun rises and sets and stuff in the game is, I'm not sure why a game that operates on the scale of, at minimum, like, year, typically, and for most of the game, many more than a single year per turn, really needs to have different lighting like this.
I guess
whichever one is most visually nice to look at and keep that on.
I also want to point out for the record that if the changing light conditions does bother you, there is an option in the game settings to not only disable that, but to also set it to a specific, in-game time of day. So you can have whatever lighting you prefer and just lock it to that setting. And I think you can even change that while you're in, like, a game. Like, you don't have to quit your game to do that.
Yeah, I recommend doing that. I did that pretty quickly. I even do that in games like Hearts of Iron, because, like, even in the context where it makes sense, where you have, like, daily ticks, like, you actually have the game advancing on an hour-by-hour basis, but the game speed is relatively high, so you're doing day-night cycles constantly. It's just annoying. It doesn't really help. It doesn't really help a lot. I mean, I guess you get some benefit because you know when the modifiers are active or whatever, but the way the game plays, it's not really practical to take advantage of that. So it winds up just being a nuisance rather than anything useful.
Well, day-night cycles are a very popular feature in, like, city-building games in particular, in large part because people just like to look at their pretty city with all the lights on. And with the focus on, like, building districts and Civ 6, like, almost being kind of like a hex-based city builder, I think maybe Firaxis was like, well, people keep asking for it in City Skylines and Sin City and all that stuff. I guess we should probably put it in, too, just so that people don't bug us for it later.
I don't know what you're talking about. Civ 6 is a war game.
It is a very neat feature. I don't know if it's necessary, but it's neat.
It's in there because rule of cool.
Yeah.
Grumble, grumble, don't leave this crap in my war game, grumble.
And again, if the hill, like the hill textures are like the only place where it really is a problem for me. Like everything else, I think, does look really good and really easy to discern. So like, if they could just fix that, like, it wouldn't even be a problem anymore. I mean, there's maybe a few other little nagging things, but not being able to tell hills from flatlands is like the only thing that actually makes a substantial difference in terms of gameplay, because it, you know, means I misclick and screw up and move a tile on, or a unit onto the wrong tile.
Yeah, I don't use humankind's cliffside type of, you know, distinction, but, you know, somewhere in the middle there, we'll be a little more able to tell the hill from the mountain.
No, if they need to do, just make like a blatant cartoony like hills that don't fit the surrounding environment at all.
Make it like the hills in that graphic where the grandparents have to walk uphill in the snow both ways.
Yeah. Put little hobbit holes in them just so we know.
There you go. That's your new neighborhood district. You have a bunch of hobbit holes in the hills.
You still wouldn't convince me to build them, but at least look at them for a moment before I pillage them from the AI or whatever.
They're useful for achievements.
And at least on, like, coasts, you know, I think the hills always have cliffs adjacent to them if they're on the coast.
Mm-hmm.
So that is one thing that does help. If they could have some other visually, you know, distinct feature of hills to go along with, you know, just the rolling texture, then I think that would go a long way.
Neighborhoods are also useful for rationalism, which is the next topic, but we're not there yet.
The rational conclusion is not to build them.
Would you prefer a good game of chess?
Hey, chess is good. Big surge in popularity lately, actually.
You can thank Netflix for that.
So, rationalism. So the proper move is 2, king e2. Got to play the Bond Cloud opener. It's the best chess opener, for sure. Wait, what are we talking about?
Not chess, but go on.
Okay, so thread started by NKH here, talking about the rationalism change and balance change leading to no balance at all. I'm not sure I agree with this, but the premise is that it's going to be harder to get the +4 adjacency, needing either the 15 pop or, what is it, making your cities pretty or some crap I never pay attention to.
You need to have, in order to get rationalism to work, which I think is 50% science output in the city, you need 15 pop city and 4 adjacency, 4 plus 4 adjacency on your,
I thought it was going to be either or.
It's or, so you get it for either. Mm. And I'm not sure, I assume they stack. So I assume you can get both if both conditions apply, but I don't know for sure.
+100?
That might be a little much.
Has that been confirmed? I find that hard to believe.
I'm not sure. I haven't tested it since it was changed, so.
But yeah, so the gist of it is that there are civs that can achieve this more easily than others, and some of them were already really good prior to the change, so that this is actually...
Korea is one of them.
Yeah, the big complaint is that it made the civs that were already really good at getting district adjacency even better.
Yeah. But, like, I'm of two minds about this, because, like, any change you make in a game that's reasonably complex, and Civ 6 certainly fits that bill, you're going to have ripple effects to surrounding mechanics that might require then further balance changes. So if they want there to be some incentive / decision-making model for improving your cities beyond what players were doing, this makes sense even if it temporarily knocks the, or skews some cities too strong or weak. And also in Fraxis' defense, there's never been any real push for making each civilization choice comparable / balanced against each other. You know, even going pretty much back to the implementation of this being meaningfully different in a mechanical sense, there has always been imbalances between civilization choices. So, okay, maybe they're strong by too much now, but that might play out, but then they can just be nerfed. And that might be justified. Who knows? But I don't know that that, like, I don't know that that should be a reason to reject the particular changes for the rationalism change itself.
And at the time period of the game when rationalism becomes active, like, it is not unreasonable to have multiple cities at 15 population. And the ones that aren't at 15 population, like, it again, isn't too hard, especially if you use district adjacency and, you know, put a government plaza. So, you know, tuck your campus in between some mountains, throw in a government plaza, you know, put the one or two other districts adjacent to it, and, you know, you've got plus four, whether the city's at 15 pop or not.
Yeah.
So it's not like they made it impossible.
Also a minor buff to ley lines.
Yeah, well, a minor buff to anything that provides an extra adjacency bonus. To campuses, anyway. Was this same change applied to the other similar policies? Like, there's a similar one, I think, for commercial hubs. Was that also changed to plus four instead of plus three?
I believe it was, but I don't have the facts to prove it.
I think commercial hubs are a little bit easier because they get, like, extra adjacency from things like harbors. And so, like, a harbor is, like, plus two adjacency for a commercial hub, I think.
Those are nice, but I don't think they're valued as much as the science. I mean, the correct answer is just to put military districts in every city and build units, but I guess you can then make a campus after that because you can't build two military districts. So, like, you can't have two encampments in one city.
Well, it is.
So you might as well build something else.
Well, Grandmaster Phil, it is a little bit difficult there, Grandmaster Phil, to win the entire game with just warriors and archers. So you're going to need a campus somewhere sooner or later.
You'd be surprised how far you can get, actually. I've tried a game or two where I just didn't build any campuses, and you can still win. Because you can really abuse your ecos, and ultimately you capture them anyway. So
yeah.
It's not impossible, but... You get more than one district slot per city for a reason, so you can probably work some other things in there. And man, if only I could be a grandmaster or something at chess, that would be incredible. You need to be pretty good for that, though. Casually stomping a friend or two is not going to get you there.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is pointed out on this thread that the condition is 15 pop or the plus 4 science district, and I think a lot of people didn't realize that. And that does make a big difference because, you know, getting one, especially if they do not stack, so it is just you get one or the other, so there's no reason to get both. Like I said, like 15 pop is not particularly hard to get to. So you'll still get use out of this policy. Maybe not as much as you used to, but you'll get use.
Yeah, it's a bit annoying for happiness and such, but you can make it work.
And I would assume that if Firaxis changed it, there must have been somebody somewhere who was complaining that it was too easy to meet the conditions for rationalism. Because the difference between plus 3 and plus 4 in adjacency for any district is actually, like, pretty substantial. Like, plus 3 districts are, I would say, easy to get with even just a little bit of planning and forethought. You know, plus 4 is considerably more challenging because it does pretty much require that you have a favorable map for it. And I think that's a big part of the reason why, you know, there's historic moments for getting districts up to plus 4. I don't think there's a historic moment for getting a plus 3 district.
Also, just to confirm that this is counting base adjacency bonus, right? Like, so if you take the double adjacency bonus thing, you're not just going to... pop rationalism everywhere, I'm assuming.
Yeah, someone, I think, in the thread confirmed that that is the case.
Okay. I figure that would be the case, but you know, it's always good to check, because sometimes game designers don't necessarily implement things as intended or don't think things through, and you could get outcomes where something like that gets implemented, where you just run the double adjacency one and get rationalism everywhere.
Right,
especially if everywhere you can manage a plus 2.
Especially if the game rounds up.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I'm personally on the fence with this change.
Yeah, I don't know that it's necessarily bad. Man, science has been so dominant in SIF for so long that it's tough to find a balancing point for the trade-offs.
Yeah, maybe. Oh, go ahead.
I kind of feel like they went first at the balancing rationalism and decided to add the other cards later, you know, because science has been so much of a main thing everybody's doing, everybody's overdoing maybe, because we all tend to zoom in on, and, you know, we have to still do an economy, we tend to zoom in on the science because that pushes the game through faster.
Yeah, and in Civ 6 defense, I think it's probably the best at providing alternatives. Like, you really can just encampment push, and if you have your units trained up well and such, they perform pretty nicely in single player. That's really, like, you could win with, like, infantry and artillery in Civ 4, just slamming numbers at the AI, even on fairly high difficulties, and beat more advanced stuff, but man, it was a grind. You took pretty heavy casualties doing it. Yeah, contrast with that to Civ 6, if you have enough promotions and general bonuses going on military units, you completely dumpster things at tech parity, and you can even still beat units in the next era forward.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Beat, I mean, your stats are higher than theirs.
Yeah, it doesn't matter how strong the other unit is if you can just focus fire it to death in one turn before it gets a chance to do anything.
Well, yeah, but you have to be strong enough to do that. So it's like, once we're talking like two eras ahead and you've got like 60 strength versus 30 strength units, even if you stack all your military modifiers, you're going to be at a disadvantage there. But if it's just one, which is pretty substantial, because it's not that hard to only lag by one tech era. Even if you're like barely trying with science, you have to really like be safe planting to be doing worse than that. Then you can fight. Like, artillery armies with generals backing them are pretty nasty stuff for the AI to deal with, even if they're using, like, literal endgame units. So they can be, like, thousands and thousands and thousands of research ahead, and you can still win that way. So, yeah, I mean, certainly with anybody competent leading the other side, they're going to win, and science is still king. But I would say definitely less so than any of the previous civs. Which is nice. Yeah, I'd say they're getting closer. And it's nice to see that you still have incentive to go science, but that they're trying to make it less obvious. That's good. I wish they took the same stance on offensive versus defensive posturing in Wars, but whatever. One thing at a time.
And if this change means that we don't have AI civs in the atomic era in 1400 AD, maybe that's a, you know, win.
Yeah,
I don't think this will make much difference.
No, it probably won't.
I doubt the AI was hitting adjacency rationals and bonuses with much reliability even previously, although it surprised me.
Well, AI cities get pretty big on the harder difficulties, so they're going to just trip over that 15-pop condition in a lot of their cities, like, without even trying, just because of all their, like, growth and yield modifiers.
But then they were already doing that previously, right?
Right. So the nerf wouldn't have mattered in that regard.
Yeah, I don't expect too much difference from the AI over this.
No, neither do I.
All right, are we ready for the next topic?
I think so. Ooh.
Ready, steady.
All right, the reloading scale of shame.
What are we doing, Paradox games now? Wait, what?
No trophies for you, or no achievements for you, unless you play on Iron Man.
Never mind that does not stop you safe going in the slightest. Not even a little bit. It makes it marginally less convenient.
I hit all F4.
I think you have to control delete. I think it's like M-Task, you can't just alt F4. But you can even like copy the save. It's such a basic crap. You can copy the save out of the Iron Man folder, like onto your desktop. And then anytime you want to go back, you can just paste that back into the folder, overwriting the Iron Man save back to what it was. It's so stupid. It's so meaningless. And yet people have such a hard-on for it. Okay, rant over. Let's look at it in the context.
Minnow has posted a thread listing the 7 levels of reloading and the scale of shame associated therewith. Beginning at the low end of the scale, which is the level of shame, The correct answer is game crashes. So if the game crashes and you reload and make the same moves, that's the lowest level of scum.
I mean, is that even, like, scum? I mean, the game crash, what are you supposed to do? Just not play it anymore?
It also has to do with repeating what you did exactly and not having realized as the game crashed, oh, I should have done X instead of Y in doing that.
I don't know. Sometimes I take the game crashing and me having to reload the save as, like, a hint from the game that I was making bad moves and I need to reevaluate them. Game's like, are you sure you want to do that? Let me just crash just to make sure you're sure you want to do that. Anyway, sorry. Continue, Canis.
The second level is the misclick, where your finger slips or your child decides to move the mouse and move the unit on their own. This is not the way that you intended to do it, but...
Or your cat or dog steps on your keyboard.
Yeah.
Yeah. Physical error as opposed to a mental error. And this is also not considered very scummy by this guy. And number three, make an unintentional move because you did not realize the setting. For example, chopping a forest thinking it will go to City A where Magnus is rushing pyramids, but the forest was actually assigned to City B. Reload and redirect the chop. This is careless, but you intended to do the right thing, so...
I would actually put this at 2, depending on the context of the game. In other words, the worse the UI, the less bad, I would say, this type of reloading is.
Well, knowing what tile is being belongs to what city is, like, as simple as just hovering over the tile, so... Like,
yeah, that's something you can check, and that's there.
It's
but
not a
since
high
we were on the we were on the topic of, like, Paradox games just a moment ago, because I brought it up, and this immediately comes to mind because of that for me. There are times in the game where like, in EU4, the game will just straight up lie to you. Like, you can mouse over the thing on the interface, and it will tell you one thing, and when you click on it, something else happens, different from what it just told you. To the extent where, like, that has to be number 2, and close to number 1 for me, if it's that bad. But if it's something where it was visually obvious, and you just didn't notice, or it's something you're aware of, and you just made a mistake, then I think it's fine here. So it really depends just how bad the... Or just how much of this was player error versus developer error. And there is a difference between those two that can be reasonably clearly drawn.
Number 4, which is halfway through the scale. Accidentally forget to do something like change policies, move a governor, or send a delegation before the end of the turn.
I would like to say that I do really wish that there was, like, a notification in the bottom right next to the end turn button that, you know, policies can be changed and governors can be assigned, because, like, right now the only indication that the game gives that you can do those things is, like, a tiny little exclamation mark icon on the, like, policy or governor button. And, yeah, it is a really easy thing to, like, not notice, like, especially if you're coming out of, like, a particularly long, you know, turn processing where, like, a lot of AI moves were happening and you still have all the animations on, so it took, like, 2 whole minutes to watch what the AI does, and then you just forgotten that you were going to change social policies. So I would chalk that one a little bit up to UI as well, just like Phil did with the previous one.
Yeah, but we're getting closer now to actual stomach.
Number 5, reload because you were moving a settler or a builder on autopath and it ends near a barbarian. This is considered a mental lapse, and get over it, basically.
I don't know, man.
You shouldn't have to move every single unit one tile at a time the whole game. Like, that is, I think, asking for way too much micromanagement from the player.
And all the game would have to do is interrupt the move if something dangerous is in the fog, you know, either being at war or a hostile unit of any kind.
To be fair, though, like, assigning a multi-turn move to a unit is risky in Civ 6 anyway, because if anything gets in the way of that, like another unit or something somewhere in the fog of war, your unit is prone to just turning around and walking the opposite direction to find
it. That's true, and that's also a serious issue with the game. One of my biggest issues with the game is just the hassle of playing it because the UI is bad.
Yeah,
it's
one of the things where I'll like just finish with a war or something like that, and instead of being like, yeah, I just won, I'm like, oh god, now I have to move all 15 of my units back to the other side of the globe, like one turn at a time, because if I just tell them all to go over there all at once, they're going to split up and go the wrong way, and they all have different move speeds, and oh my gosh, it's just going to be a nightmare.
Yeah, it's awful. And I would put this higher too, like this, because this is just obnoxious. It is a disrespect to player time, and then to say that the player should be penalized for not painstakingly moving one X at a time because the developers can't make a UI. I don't know, man. I'm not nearly as inclined. No. I would put this higher than the previous one, and maybe even closer to misclick.
Now, if you're moving your settlers and builders and civilian units into potentially dangerous territory without an escort, that is 100% on you.
Yeah, if you're blindly moving like onto something that burns up all your movement or something, sure. Yeah, I'd agree then. That's when this is where it belongs. But not from autopathing. The fact that autopathing exists implies that autopathing should be usable and not a newbie trap. And this is acknowledging that using autopathing is a trap, which I don't agree with. I don't agree with that autopathing should be a trap, so yeah.
Number 6A, reload because you made a military blunder like exposing an archer to get killed by a sword. Military cheating.
Now we're into problems.
Yeah, this is straight scumming at this point, yes.
Yes, now we are into legit cheating. Now, do you make, like, a special exception for cases where the game UI told you you would win the battle, but then the roll actually made you lose the battle, and, like, that makes all the difference?
It depends on the game. In Civ 6, it should really show you that there's a range of possible outcomes.
Yeah.
You don't know which of those range of outcomes will happen. And if that was the information presented, then I would make no exception, because
yeah,
you were taking a risk then.
It would be nice if they could somehow, like, show you, like, a bell curve of, like, the possible outcomes. Like, you are most likely to do 20 hit points in damage, but, you know, you are 5% likely to do 25 points of damage and kill the unit, you know?
I mean, it's not that hard. Here's the Light Magic 3 managed it decades ago. I'm sure they could manage to give you a damage range on your UI bar, just like that did.
Yeah, so even this one has a little asterisk next to it saying that, you know, UI can screw you over and potentially force this as opposed to...
I still think it's cheating, but it's bad UI. But once you know that this is a possibility, you're kind of lying to yourself then. But yeah, I do agree that the UI can cause problems here. And they really shouldn't. It should not be something in the game where, how do I put this? If the information that's already available to you is presented in a more clear fashion, then your decision making would change. That's a bad thing for the game. That's a bad thing in any strategy cycle. Any time that happens, that's a bad UI choice by the developer. And so, yeah, but the vast majority of times players do this, it tells us to say I'm scumming. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I mean, we all know that there is a die roll associated with making a combat attack in, you know, every Civilization game. So, you know, we kind of don't have any excuse in that regard. We know, but, you know, I can definitely see for, like, a less experienced player, yeah, that would be an extenuating circumstance. But
if it's your first time playing, you're just going to straight up screwed, because there's nothing the game does to indicate the range of possibilities when you're just mousing over and right-clicking.
But it said decisive victory. Why did I lose?
Not only does it say decisive victory, it flashes a health bar that is empty outright. Like, it is directly implying something different from what happens.
And it's especially troublesome. The one place where it does really get me is the situations where, like, both units have, like, critical HP, and I have, like, a little bit more, and I'm like, well, I should be able to kill this last enemy unit and survive, but I'm rolling the dice.
Yeah. But that's pertinent information. Like, the game should not represent it as there's no chance that this unit will die, and you'll definitely kill the opposing unit, and then not do that. It's just not okay.
Yeah, and that is... kind of the heavy implication of the UI is, yes, this will be a decisive victory. You know, it doesn't tell you you're going to end with one hit point and there's so much percent chance that the other unit will kill you.
Yeah.
So, yeah, even with this one, I can see some extenuating circumstances.
And I haven't seen it recently, but there were times where the game would tell me I was doing a ranged attack, and then I'd right-click, and then my unit would move and not fire.
That's not even
ambiguous. That goes right up to number one, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons I always use the ranged attack button or keyboard shortcut instead of just, like, doing a move click, because, yeah, I can't trust the game to do the thing I wanted it to do.
Although I have not encountered that too recently. Like, it's been a number of years. Maybe I've just been lucky.
Maybe it was fixed at some point.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I think that's the more likely.
Number 6B. Reload when you realize you built something wrong many turns later. Going back, for example, to start a wonder you missed earlier, or change campus you were building to a horseman. Domestic cheating.
I was really surprised to not see the specific example of you have one turn left to build a wonder, and the CPU built it first, and you reload a few turns earlier to chop and beat them to it. Like, that would be the example I would cite in this
case. That's what you get for building wonders.
And telling me you're building them out loud. Oh, wait.
Well, that was a special case. I was not directly involved in that, but that was such a funny moment.
Although,
this is Team Chapel and X Turn. Whip.
To his credit, though, you can see if the other civ that's building that wonder is, you know, on the part of the map that you have revealed. Even if you don't have visibility, it will show that they are building a wonder, and it will show a pretty granular view of how close they are to building it. I kind of wish that you could just highlight over the tile and it would say, like, wonder 90% complete or whatever. But, you know, if you look very closely at the model, like, you can see if you are further ahead on that wonder than the other civ. Of course, if they're, you know, off on another continent and you haven't seen them at all yet, then you have no way of knowing. But if you are competing...
Or they can chop it.
Yeah, well, that's true. They could chop it, too. But the game actually does give you the ability to see, you know, how competitive you are about going for particular wonders against the other civs that you have met and have visibility to.
There, too, if that's available to you in the UI, why make it so cryptic and obnoxious to access the information? Either you should make that information accessible to the player so that they can trivially interact with it, or don't make it accessible to the player at all. Like, pick one.
Yeah, the one other instance where I wish the game would tell you how far along the other civ is to building something is with city walls. Because you have sometimes those situations where attempting to siege a city, and it doesn't have a wall, and then you suddenly see the half-built wall pop up on that city, and it's like, okay, well, I know they're building the walls, but I don't know how long it's going to take them.
It always feels like it comes up almost instantly after you see the first.
Yeah, I feel like, it always feels like it's like two or three turns later. And it's like, what the heck? It takes me 9 turns to build a wall. Why are they doing it in 3? Maybe they're running lines.
They have bonuses.
Well, yeah, that's true.
They just bought it, lol. Because that's
the Valletta, here we come. Number 7. Reload and make moves in a different order to change the RNG to affect combat, to get different rewards from a village, rewriting history until you like it. The filthiest of cheating.
I mean, we were all expecting this to be here, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, someone in the thread also listed the significant example of an AI surprise declares on you before you were prepared. So you reload like 5 or 10 turns earlier and build an army.
Yeah, that would be right there at 6B. It's the same kind of mindset.
And now for my final thought. No, I am not Jerry Springer. The joke here is that this guy cares about what other people are doing in their single-player games.
Well, there's that, too.
Yeah, I mentioned that. I responded on this, and I'm like, you know, if you're playing a single-player game, it doesn't really matter what you do. You know, play however you like. And in fact, stage scumming is a very valuable learning tool if you're inexperienced. And in previous episodes of the show, I have said, if you are learning the game, stage scum all you want, because it will teach you the game mechanics.
Actually, yeah, it very much frustrates me that it is extremely hard to do that in Dominion, because, like, you don't want it in real games because it's cheating, but if you just want to have a battle scenario play out over and over again and see the impact of making one decision versus another, and just, like, test that, like, okay, what if I put this unit here? What if I told this unit to do this instead of this? How does that impact the battle? How does that affect how many castle sweeps I take? Does it change the outcome of who wins, etc.? There are so many possible iterations, and it's not practical to set up that same scenario over and over while just making small iterations. And you could learn a lot from that. And it's the same thing in Civ. If you are reloading to try to learn sequences or make plans or something, I mean, yeah, it kind of quote unquote taints the game in the context of the game you're playing. But if you're doing that with the goal that in future games you now have the answer to the scenario every time, so you don't need to worry about it anymore, then it just saves you time. It's a legit thing as part of the learning experience.
Yeah, unfortunately, though, I don't know if it's fortunately or unfortunately, I guess it depends on how you look at it, Civilization, and Civilization VI in particular, is an exceedingly complicated game, so even we are still learning new things about it, and I still face scum quite a bit, especially in the later eras of the game where I'm just less familiar with the game mechanics and what things do because, you know, how often do you actually get to the atomic era of a game and, you know, use all the units and build all the buildings and, you know, all that stuff. So
I generally don't, just because I don't know that I could learn a lot from most of them. Man, playing through turns is the last thing I want to do if I spent 20 turns fighting the, or 20 minutes fighting the UI is go back and undo all of that. Oh, my gosh.
Even just one turn can be 10, 15, 20 minutes of real time.
Well, I'm faster than that, but even so, it's still, if we're talking like 5 turns or something, oh, my gosh, that is, like, I don't care what kind of benefit I'm getting from that. At that point, I'd rather just lose, I think.
But yeah,
I want to rewind the past hour of my life to replay these 5 turns.
Yeah, heck with that. But there's also, like, if you can just experiment with it and burn turns and be less optimal but still get to see how that mechanic interacts, I usually just do it that way.
Yeah.
Because, like, I'm not in any competitions or anything, so...
Yeah, and I always do get particularly annoyed with myself for reloading a late-game turn because, you know, not only does it just take longer, like, even I think the load time is longer later in the game, and it takes longer to actually... play the turn, and then it takes longer for the AIs to simulate their turns. But it's also the fact that at that point in the game, the decisions are usually less meaningful.
Yeah. In terms of the outcome of the game, yeah, for sure. You kind of know how it's going to end by late game in most cases.
But I do want to make a couple callbacks to previous topics, which is the example of accidentally moving a unit onto a hill because you couldn't tell whether or not it was a hill. That probably falls under like the first, that falls under like the first 2 or 3. And then someone, Mount Suribachi, said, you forgot that you are playing on consoles and can't go more than an hour without crashing, requiring an autosave to be reloaded. You don't reload for anything else on console because it takes several hours to load a save. Apparently load times on the consoles are not particularly good, and I posted in response to that, like, you know, I played Skyrim and Fallout New Vegas on consoles. I remember the pain of spending more time in loading screens than actually playing the game because I had to reload several times an hour to undo Bethesda's bugs and crashes.
There's just no need for that on modern consoles anymore. What the heck? But then Civ 6 has been pretty badly optimized from the start. So I guess it doesn't surprise me that it struggles with consoles. Civ 5 was too, to be fair.
So our next and I think last topic for this Saturday is an article on Game Rant, Civilization VI, 10 Map Seeds You Need to Try. And I don't know that we're going to have a whole lot to talk about this other than that this article exists, and they recommend trying out some of these maps. So, you know, some of our listeners might want to check them out as well. They did it as like a top 10. And in fact, I actually am really curious to try the number 10 one, because it looks like it actually starts you off on like a one tile wide, like, bit of land between two bodies of water. That's always kind of like just an interesting strategic or tactical position to start the game in, just immediately having your capital be on that canal space between multiple bodies of water.
Yeah, that's the most interesting part of that one. I think that's what the topic even says. There's lots of resources around you, and you're between two oceans.
Yeah. In fact, I was specifically going back to the previous topic of save scumming to re-roll different maps. I had recently been trying to get a similar start for a Byzantium game. Just to play it out. So now at least I have a map seed that I can use to guarantee that I will get a start that gives me that starting condition. The one thing that I dislike about this article is that it doesn't say anything about like what the other game settings are for that seed, because I don't know what size map this is on, and I don't know if that makes a difference. Like if you change the map size or like the map type, like continents versus archipelago, and you put in the same map seed, do you get the exact same map? Does changing the size give you a similar map that's just bigger with more tiles or less tiles? Like, how does anyone know how that works?
I don't know offhand, but I'd have to imagine that if you picked like archipelago and the seed was for Pangaea, that you'd get different outcomes.
Or does the same map seed just always generate the same map regardless of your settings? I would have to imagine that's not the case, because you can set all of those settings independent of the map seed. Like, it's not like putting in the custom map seed grays out all the options. And I think even when you're in the game setup, like, it shows you what map seed you're going to use, and you can still change all those settings. So the fact that this article doesn't specify any of that stuff, I'm just going to assume it's all standard game settings, standard game size, continents, et cetera. But
some of them clearly say Pangaea in the article description now.
Maybe.
So at least for those, I would say you'd probably want to set Pangaea if you want to get the same experience.
Yeah, so writers of Game Rant, next time you write an article like this, make sure you include all the other game settings that went into creating that particular map or game condition, because
also throw us a bone and give us one or two just absolutely horrendous starts. They're just awful for one reason or another.
Yeah, well, you can go to
those are always fascinating too.
You can go to Reddit for that.
Well, there's one in here that starts you down in the tundra. I mean, you are in this game, they're Russia, that's why they started down there. But if you wanted to play the tundra start thing.
Yeah, there is. It's number 4, I think, is the one.
Yeah, I see number 4, but number 4 is too good by the standards I'm describing.
Yeah, there's a lot of resources. Like, there's like 2 or 3 sources of fish right there. There's a bunch of, I think that's silver.
And you have, like, a couple good tiles to work immediately. That's way too good.
And their capital also has, like, 2 tiles between them and one of the natural wonders that I think just gives you extra food on every tile adjacent. So those tons of tiles are generating, like, 3 food each minimum.
You have a big food icon, a hammer, and 2 culture on 1 tile there. Like, I would not describe that as necessarily a bad start.
Yeah.
You might be choked off a little bit in expansion, but I think you could play around this without considering this a bad start, typically.
Yeah, definitely.
This is way too good for what I'm describing.
Yeah, that is a better start than most of my non-Tundra starts.
Yeah.
I like the one where you're surrounded by a crater of mountains.
which number is that?
Number 8.
Number 8 and 7
are both very defensible.
Number 8.
Yeah, number 7 is similar in that the capital is literally surrounded by mountains. Like, almost every tile that is 2 spaces away from the capital is a mountain, and 3 of them are volcanoes.
It'd be extremely hard to attack either of those positions.
One of them is Vesuvius, too.
And some of these pictures just show, like, a zoomed-out picture of the mini-map, which doesn't really tell us all that much about the starting map conditions, because we can't see what resources and stuff are there. So, you know, it's pretty typical for clickbait sites like Game Rant, but, you know, there's still some interesting stuff in there.
Yeah, number five looks like it's interesting for multiplayer because you've got two good-sized continents. There's a small island continent thing in between them, but you still need to do cartography to get across.
Yeah, there's like one tile of ocean on one side between the continents. I do have to say, though, that I tend to dislike those maps that put the continents close enough together where you can actually like meet everybody well before getting cartography. If I'm playing on a continents map, like that is specifically something that I don't want to happen.
Yeah, well, with this map, even if you got, even if you were on the right-hand side continent and you got somebody to the island to sit out there in the water and hope you saw one of the other AI's boats or units or something, there would very easily still be people up in the northwest of the other continent you would never meet until cartography anyway.
True. I mean, unless they all send a boat down there for some reason, but that's,
yeah,
that's not likely, especially once Borders expansion starts locking out the water.
And it looks like both of them have, one has the southern passage, one has the northern passage against the ice. So it's not like they could go around either, necessarily.
Yeah. I would like that map, number five, a lot more if on the left, the western continent, you see, like, there's, like, a big, like, inland bay kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I would like it a lot more if a lot more of that water were traversable earlier in the game so that you could actually have, like, an inland sea, you know, like, Mediterranean kind of naval situation where you can actually sail from one end to the other in a reasonable amount of time.
Yeah, it's actually got quite a bit of ocean, especially, like, down on one side of it. It's, like, the way the map normally forms, you think it would have made more sea instead of ocean.
Yeah. Yeah, there's, like, the tips of those two ends of the bay are, like, six tiles apart, but there's still two tiles of ocean in between them. So you can't traverse it with a galley. You gotta go around. And there's also a couple of decent Civ-specific maps here. There's a desert map seed for number two for people who want to play as, like, Mali or Nubia or someone like that.
Nate, I looked at the desert one before, and I was going to say something about that, but then I realized, no, actually, that's a decent desert, because there's oasis, there's a river down in the south, and it's like, oh, that's actually all right.
And I think they also mentioned that there's, like, two natural wonders within pretty close
range,
too. Yeah,
I can see the delicate arch down there. I'm not sure what the other one is.
It's one of those, like, Nordic names that's super hard to pronounce, but I don't think it's in the screenshot.
Okay.
I don't know how to pronounce that one. Maybe Canis can try it out for us.
Which word is this?
Under Map Seed 2, the natural wonder name.
Oh, Hiyafialiyoko?
There you go.
Oh, okay, so Icelandic volcano again. Just in a different place.
Canis saves us.
I try. I'm not actually that good at it, though.
So, yeah, if you're looking for some interesting Civ 6 game experiences to have while we're all waiting for Firaxis to announce whatever the heck the January DLC will be, give some of these a try.
And make sure every opponent is Montezuma or Shaka.
Or Alexander.
Oh god, 1,000 Montezumas. Ah!
Slightly scary.
Back in Mrs. Florida's Mad Scientist, when he was doing his roleplay challenges, one of them was everybody was Montezuma on the map. That was interesting.
And wasn't that back when Montezuma was, like, especially aggressive?
He had the reputation for it, and he was up there in Civ 4 AI personalities. He actually wasn't the most, either in units or in aggression, but he was one of the ones that could plot it pleased, and he was pretty darn aggressive. So his reputation was well-earned, but he just wasn't as bad as somebody like Shaka. Shaka built units even more frequently, and cared for religion less, so it was even harder to work with Shaka than Montezuma. Montezuma, you could actually get to friendly sometimes because he cared about religion. So if you were in his faith and there was somebody else he hated initially, as long as you avoided trading with that person and you are on good terms with Montezuma, you could almost always get him to friendly before things hit the fan between you.
And to be honest, ever since Rise and Fall introduced loyalty to Civ 6, I found Montezuma to be much more of a pushover because he can't get away with forward settling and attacking you anymore because that city is much more likely to flip from loyalty pressure.
Yeah, well, in any of the SIP games, he uses almost never a threat to land. He's just a threat to attack you early and cause problems.
Yeah, my experience is one of two things happens with Montezuma. He either is successful and steamrolls over another Civ and becomes major power for the rest of the game, or he just gets his like butt handed to him right at the beginning of the game and is conquered.
Well, even when he wipes someone out, though, it's not like he techs especially well, or like he just makes more units, but by then you can handle that. It's really only on the opening turns where that's really a threat.
It just always is scary to, like, discover cartography, sail to the other continent, and find that, like, Montezuma owns all of it. It's not
actually
as scary as it seems, but it's just always scary to see that.
I don't know if scary is the right word. I feel like when I observe something like that, I just feel like somebody placed a weight on me when it comes to finishing the game. It's like, oh, God, slogging through this is going to be awful. Because that's what it would ultimately come down to. Because at that point, you don't even have, in most cases, a safe place to, like, land your armies and consolidate them before moving them into attack. Like, you have to build up a navy that's strong enough to start hammering down coastal cities and get you a beachhead, and then you can move your units in, and you have to be quick about it because of loyalty, and...
Which I believe we talked a lot about in our last episode before the new year.
Yeah, but when it's, like, all the entire continent is 1AI like that, like, you have to blow away the walls and then, I guess, not take the city right away and try to run up in there. You can do it. I'm not saying you can't, but, yeah, it's just such a chore. It almost makes you wish that there's some other victory in the game besides just conquering them. But maybe you get lucky and there's a coastal capital and you can pull it off anyway.
Well, wouldn't you also have to conquer all the other capitals that Montezuma had conquered, or...?
Yeah, you would. I just hope they're all coastal, or most of them are, so you can go for an all-in on them rather than trying to worry about loyalty pressure or anything. You just take them all close at the same time and win. Too bad there's no other solutions. Just have to take all the cities.
It's such a solution for any SIF game.
Exactly. Well, it's the correct way to play. All right. Well, thank you all for joining us on Polycast episode 376. I hope we have brought you some joy along with the proper military units we are always bringing along. I'm the Bean Team, and I was joined by Canis Albinus.
Someday, I'll be normal.
Makalua.
Still doesn't want to play chess with me because I pants it and I don't use strategy.
And Mega Bears fan.
Time to watch the Bears embarrass themselves on national television in the playoffs.
Again.
They could win.
Again. Yeah.
Civilization 3, 4, 5, Beyond Earth, and 6 sound clips, copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright The Polycast at thepolycast.net.
Okay, stream is ended.
I'll play you in chess if you want. I've got,
Because you were talking about, oh yeah, you have to start with the strategy. It's like, oh dear. I just sit there and go, oh, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. I don't have it.
Well, the opening I described is a meme opening, because moving King E2 is like a joke. One of the Grand Masters, Hikaru Nakamura, calls it the Bong Cloud Opener. And about a month or two ago, he used it in a professional tournament, because like, he was in a position where win or loss, he couldn't affect his final standing. So he just whipped out the Bong Cloud in a serious match. And... although he was losing for a good chunk of it in terms of computer evaluations, eventually his opponent made a mistake and he won anyway. And there were a lot of people who were pretty salty about that.
I have seen some stuff about chess forever before. I can imagine how salty that was.
And then the best player of today, Magnus Carlsen, was asked about it. And he like kept a straight face as he gave a serious analysis, quote unquote. about the various types of Bong Cloud openers, and he's, like, trying to keep a straight face as he's switching his king and queen at the start, calling it opening theory and craft.
Oh, my.
I like that he did that. The world champion answered the question that way. And then when they asked him what he would do if Hikaru played it against him, he's like, I just moved my king to E7.